So what I want to do today is talk about what's going on in financial markets at the moment and what's been a bit of a recap in a few markets about what's been going on over the last few years. So it's been a little over 3 years since the onset of the crisis in August 2007. And since that time, financial markets have varied quite substantially, obviously, in terms of pricing, volumes and functioning. Conditions in global markets today are now markedly improved from their dire position in the last quarter of 2008. But markets have not returned to their pre-2007 state generally, but that's probably a good thing as those conditions were not sustainable, as indeed they weren't sustained. So notwithstanding this, though, conditions in some markets remain a bit fragile, reflected in still elevated volatility. In part, I think that's because the events of 2008 are a recent memory, and practitioners now know how to retreat rapidly instead of this process taking over a year, as occurred between August 07 and September 08. And we saw some evidence of this behaviour back in May this year. So what I want to do today is talk about the state of play in financial markets, focusing mainly on the foreign exchange market and the domestic bond market. I'll focus on structure and functioning and how these have changed over the past 3 years. But an important point to make is that throughout the period, Australian financial markets have generally operated with much less dislocation than those in other parts of the world, and that remains true today. So let me talk about the foreign exchange market first. So the FX market has been the most resilient of all markets, I think, throughout the financial crisis. Indeed, its resilience and the increasing attractiveness of foreign exchange as an asset class has seen many financial institutions actually expand their employment in this area while they've been cutting back elsewhere. The most recent data published by the Foreign Exchange Committees confirm this view. So this is the data from the six largest foreign exchange markets, which came out week before last. It shows that turnover in the foreign exchange markets increased by 30% from the lows of early 2009 to be above its pre-crisis level. The same picture can be obtained from the just-released BIS Triennial Survey, which came out last week, which shows that global turnover in FX markets averaged US $4 trillion a day in April 2010, 20% higher than when the previous survey was done in April 2007, so just before the crisis sort of got going. By market, that growth in foreign exchange turnover has been broad-based. The UK, which is the largest market, experienced slightly above average growth, so London did not lose out as a financial centre in terms of foreign exchange, while market share declined in the rest of Europe. The Australian market's relative position was little changed, remaining the seventh largest market. Where there was more variation was in growth rates by currency. So among the major currencies, the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar experienced the fastest growth, with turnover increasing 50% and 40% respectively for those two currencies. So that's from over the past 3 years, turnover in the Aussie has grown by about 40%. As a result, the Aussie dollar has taken over from the Swiss franc to be the fifth most traded currency globally. The Aussie-US cross remains the fourth most traded currency pair after Euro-US and after the Euro, the US dollar and the yen. Turnover involving the US dollar grew slightly less than the average. However, the US dollar still maintains its dominant role in financial markets, being involved in about 85% of all transactions. The number has to add up to 200 because of the currency on each side. While turnover in all instruments has grown over the past year, growth has been fastest in the spot and forward instruments than in FX swaps. So what I've got here is this is turnover from those six markets again, broken down into forward, spot, derivatives and swaps. So you can see from this that spot and forwards turnover has rebounded by about 40% since early 09, and volumes are now above those in 2007. In contrast, turnover in swaps has grown by around 20% and remains about 10% below its peak. So I think part of the explanation for why spot turnover and forwards turnover has been a little bit more rapid than in other instruments may be related to the growth of high-frequency trading, but we are unable, at this stage at least from the data we've got from the BIS survey, to completely break that out, but there is a reasonable amount of corroborating evidence which suggests that is the case. The difference in growth between spot and derivatives markets reflects the varied use of their instruments. There's a strong correlation between growth in spot and forwards turnover and international trade, which I'll show you here. So what we've got here is trade is the light blue line, reasonably for most of the world, and then spot and forwards turnover. So trade has increased by more than 30% since the trough in 2009, and that's rebounded the growth in spot and forwards turnover. The recovery in cross-border capital flows has also contributed to the pickup in spot and forwards turnover, but the recovery in cross-border flows has been more muted than it has been in trade. So those capital flows are likely to be part of the explanation for the slower growth in swaps turnover, which are more dependent on financial activity than our spot and forwards. So along with the rebound in turnover, which you can see here, liquidity in the foreign exchange market has also improved. So when I spoke to this forum last time, I talked a bit about the difference between liquidity and turnover. So they're not exactly the same thing, although they're somewhat related. So one measure that we tend to look at to work out in terms of assessing liquidity is the bid-ask spread. And so showing this for the Aussie dollar here, so what I've got here is the intraday range in absolute terms for the Aussie, and then the bid-ask spread is in the Aussie-US. So you can see in 2008, and into the first part of 2009, the blowout in the bid-ask spread. But you can see since then there's been a steady improvement in market conditions, at least on this measure. So, but you can also see that in May this year, that bid-ask widened again as the problems in Europe resurfaced. Although that, obviously you can see that episode was fairly short-lived and conditions have continued to improve since then. So while turnover has recovered, the pricing of foreign exchange swaps has been affected by the events of the financial crisis in a more long-lasting way. So historically, the implicit cost of borrowing US dollars through the swap market was the same as borrowing directly in the US dollar money market, so i.e. the same as US dollar LIBOR. So in other words, covered interest parity held, and there was no implicit basis in the FX swap market. So that's what I'm showing here is the basis in the Euro-US. So you can see prior to 2007, basically there was none, which is just that's just covered interest parity. But obviously, during the crisis, the basis in the swap market widened considerably, implying a large premium for borrowing US dollars under swap. So the pricing indicator, it was considerably cheaper to borrow US dollars directly in the interbank market than under swap. You can see, though, that the basis has narrowed significantly from its peak in late 2008, but it remains still fairly wide at around 50 basis points at the moment. So the origin of this positive basis is the dislocation in money markets that emerged through 2007 and 2008. And this issue is discussed in detail in a CGFS paper, which is Committee on Global Financial Stability paper, which was published earlier this year and is available on the BIS website. So it was a group that I chaired which looked at this issue in a reasonable amount of detail, and if you're interested in that, I'll direct you there. But to give you a quick summary of what we sort of came up with there, which is not overly surprising, but prior to the crisis, obviously banks outside the US and most notably in Europe built up large US dollar asset positions which were funded in part by rolling short-term US dollar borrowings. So in other words, they were running a large maturity mismatch between their short-term funding and their long-term asset positions. In the second half of 2007, those banks started to suffer funding difficulties in the money markets, and they found it increasingly difficult to borrow the US dollars that they needed to fund their asset positions. They couldn't sell those asset positions because those asset positions were incredibly illiquid. They couldn't, being European banks, they did not have direct access to the Fed, so they were their natural funding was in their own currency, but they were funding these assets in foreign currency. They were holding foreign currency assets and they needed the foreign currency funding. Following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the situation worsened considerably as general counterparty concerns saw the supply of US dollars in the unsecured money market basically just disappear. In response, those non-US banks increasingly sought to obtain dollars via the swap market, but supply of dollars in the swap market was also tight, which saw that spike in the basis there in October 2008. So under normal market conditions, you'd expect that pricing discrepancy would be arbitraged away, but there are a number of constraints on the ability of anyone to arbitrage over this period, obviously in part related to the significant counterparty concerns, increased risk aversion and balance sheet losses, all restricted the potential arbitrage activity. Counterparty concerns also generated significant credit tiering in the market for US dollars. So the calculation I've got here is using LIBOR. But in late 2008 and early 2009, few banks were actually able to borrow at LIBOR. So if we use the euro-dollar rate, which is a broader measure of US dollar borrowing costs, it indicates that for many banks, funding costs were considerably higher than at LIBOR. When we account for the credit tiering by calculating the basis using the euro-dollar rate, then the apparent deviation from covered interest parity through 2008 is smaller, although it's still there, and is in fact still there today. Actions by policymakers, and in particular the central bank swap line set up with the Fed, acted to ease constraints in the market. But as you can see, the basis has not returned to zero and remains sensitive to counterparty concerns. And so that spike up in 2010, again, is in May this year when concerns about euro sovereign debt saw the basis increase again. Unlike the earlier episode, though, it appears that the credit tiering in May was isolated to a smaller group of European banks, but again, primarily the European banks. So while the swap lines have been reactivated by the major central banks, their usage has been extremely small this time around compared to the extensive usage in 08 and 09. So I turn to the domestic foreign exchange market. This is the data that we collect on a monthly basis from all the participants in the local market. It's available on our website. It's also available on the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee's website. So you can see there that turnover in the local market has rebounded from its lows of early 2009 by about 60%, which is actually a much greater increase than in other markets. Somewhat in contrast to other markets, as you can see here, the light blue line, swaps turnover in Australia has outpaced growth in other instruments, and turnover is now higher than prior to the crisis, while spot and forwards turnover has been basically unchanged from October 2009. So the growth in swaps is likely to be related to the improvement in risk appetite and appreciation of the dollar over the past year, of our dollar. So as in the pre-crisis period, market yields remain high here relative to the rest of the world. And as markets have stabilised, there's been a renewed interest in the carry trade. So we've got here a couple of just indicators of what might be going on in terms of carry. The graph on the left, the CME spec futures positions, I think is an okay element, but basically doesn't tell you anything you don't already know from the exchange rate itself, and obviously someone else has to be on the other side of this, but anyhow. These are the contracts which are designated as indicating spec elements. So one way for an investor, obviously, to generate a carry return is to hold an open forward position in the Aussie. Those positions are typically short-term and rolled frequently using FX swaps, hence the fact that the FX swaps are high at the moment is an indicator of the interest in carry trade. You can see on the right-hand side what we've got is a measure of Japanese retail investors' net positions, which show high levels of net long Aussie dollar positions. In fact, Japanese retail net long positions are even larger than prior to the crisis, notwithstanding they got basically wiped out in 2008. The pickup in options turnover that I showed in the previous graph is consistent with this pickup in carry trade. I talked about the improvement in liquidity in the local FX market, and along with the improvement in liquidity, volatility in the Aussie has also declined significantly from its peak in October 2008, but actually remains well above its pre-crisis level, and you can see there that spike in 2010 again is in May. The Australian cross-currency swap market has also experienced strong growth, with turnover now close to its previous peak. So that market is particularly important in Australia, as Australian banks, including the one we're sitting in at the moment, make extensive use of cross-currency swaps to hedge the exchange rate risk associated with their foreign currency bond issuance. So Australia has a large share of the cross-currency swap market, and this share has actually grown over the past 3 years from about 5% of the global market in 07 to about 11% today. So part of the reason why that increase in share has occurred is the fact that Australian institutions accounted for a larger share of global foreign currency bond issuance last year than they had done historically. But to some extent, that was as much a function of the denominator as the numerator. So the Australian banks did issue more in foreign currency bond markets last year than they had done previously. But at the same time, global bond issuance actually dropped off quite sharply, particularly by financial institutions. So the Australian banks were issuing a bit more, but in a much smaller market, which results in their share being larger than it had been historically. So the increased share resulted from the fact that the Australian banks were able to maintain their access to bond markets due to their strong balance sheet and particularly their high credit rating and, for a period, the government guarantee. The premium to obtain Aussie dollars under swap, though, has risen compared to the pre-crisis period. So this is the, this is the cross-currency basis for swapping between Aussie and US dollars. You can see that prior to the crisis, Australian institutions generally paid a small premium to swap foreign currency into Australian dollars, generally about 5 to 8 basis points, which basically arises because domestic issuers tend to issue a greater amount of foreign currency bonds than foreign issuers of kangaroo and other Aussie-denominated bonds. The crisis saw the balance shift even further towards Australian issuers as kangaroo issuance slowed to a halt. In fact, there was a period where there was basically no kangaroo issuance, resulting in that higher basis. But in, so far, over the course of this year, though, kangaroo issuers have returned to the market in quite a fair bit of volume, and that's driven that basis back down. But as you can see, it's still higher than it was pre-crisis. Although, as I showed you with the euro, US dollar one, basically all of these cross-currency swap spreads are higher than they were pre-crisis. Let me now talk a little bit about the local bond market. And one important point to emphasise is that holders of Australian bonds have seen almost no deterioration in asset quality over the course of the past 3 years, which is something you could not say about most bond markets around the world. But heightened global risk aversion has significantly affected pricing. And while spreads have narrowed over the past year, relative pricing has changed, and consequently so has the structure of the market. So let me just give you an overview of what the bond market looks like. And so first of all, just look at what it looked like in 2007. So you can see in the run-up to 2007, the particularly strong growth in asset-backed issuance there, which is basically mortgage-backed securities. So in 2007, asset-backed securities accounted for 40% of the flow in the local government, in the non-government bond market in Australia. So the onset of the financial crisis significantly changed those issuance patterns. So the previous one was a graph of the stocks. This is a graph of the flows. So you can see there in 2007, the light blue bit, which is asset-backed securities, being a healthy part, 40% of the issuance. In 2008, you can see that asset-backed issuance drops away considerably. You can also see that kangaroo issuance drops away considerably. In fact, everything drops away considerably except for financial issuance. And then in 2009, the point I was talking about earlier, you can see the large increase in financial issuance. Now, part of this is because what was going on in 2009 is because of the decline in asset-backed issuance, the banks who weren't relying on that asset-backed issuance picked up a greater share of the market share. They were more reliant. They tend to use wholesale funding a lot more, so we thought that explained some of the shifting composition. At the same time, corporates tended to return to the banking sector to get their funding rather than relying on non-intermediated sources. And that's so basically there was re-intermediation on both the housing and the business side, which saw bank balance sheets grow, which resulted in that large increase in bank funding. So you can see that in 2010 so far, the pace of new issuance by banks has slowed compared with last year. But this year, issuance by the financial institutions has been pretty much entirely in their own name rather than last year. A reasonable amount of it was under the government guarantee. You can also see there that large increase in kangaroo issuance, which is the yellow bit. So despite all these classes continuing to perform well from a credit perspective, spreads have widened considerably during the financial crisis to historic highs, and you can see there for the light blue bit most dramatically for RMBS. So as investor risk aversion has eased, those spreads have narrowed, but they still remain well above pre-crisis levels. And perhaps more importantly for the structure of the market, that relative pricing has also changed significantly. So you can see there that the cost of bond market funding has declined for the higher rate of banks compared with RMBS issuance and corporate issuance. So in the RMBS market, over the last 6-9 months or so, primary and secondary market spreads have broadly converged, and in the last few months, the RFM has supported new issuance at tighter spreads. So although RMBS spreads remain high by historical standards, recent issues, including those without AFM support, have been cost-effective for the issuers. Nevertheless, the shift in relative pricing suggests that the asset-backed segment is and is likely to remain a smaller share of the market for quite some time to come than it was prior to the crisis. The decline in AAA asset-backed issuance, though, has only had a modest effect on the credit composition of the market because it's been, over the last 6-9 months or so, it's been offset by strong AAA issuance. So, as you can see there, the funding for the banks is more expensive than it was pre-crisis, but has narrowed from its peaks in 08. RMBS issuance is considerably more expensive than it was pre-crisis, and is wide. The gap in terms of how much further it is wider is larger than it is for direct wholesale issuance. So just to sort of wrap up a couple of the points I'm trying to give you, and basically a description of what's been going on in some of the markets here, is that conditions in financial markets have fluctuated through a pretty wide range over the past 3 years, which goes without saying. Recently, conditions have been somewhat fragile, but obviously considerably improved from late 08 and early 09. The FX market, I think, throughout the past 3 years has probably been one of the most resilient of the markets globally, and has actually expanded rapidly over the past year. In that market, unlike a number of others around the world, conditions have generally returned to those before 2007. In other markets, I don't think it's likely that the pre-crisis conditions will prevail again anytime soon. Throughout the past 3 years, Australian financial markets have been less affected than other markets. However, there's been a marked effect on the structure and pricing of the Australian bond market, as evidenced here. An increase in paper issued by financial institutions has offset the decline in asset-backed issuance. Risk margins across all asset classes have tightened over the past year, but as you can see here, they remain noticeably higher than they were in 2007, and as I said earlier, I don't think we're going to see them go back to those tight levels any time in the foreseeable future. So let me stop there. As I said, that basically trying to give you an overview of where of the change structure to some, of the Australian financial markets over the past 3 years or so, where the structure is most particularly changed in the bond market, foreign exchange market, basically, has just been a story of onwards and upwards, really. So I'll finish there and happy to take any questions that people might have.
Paul Verscher here. Guy, have you done much thinking on any impact to the functioning of financial markets from the proposed US over-the-counter legislation?
Yes. I mean, we are. Partly you've got to see exactly how it ends up playing out. One issue which concerns me to some extent is that I think there's a risk that some of this is some of these changes are going to concentrate the market in the hands of a small number of players. The market's already pretty concentrated, but driving some of the moving to an exchange, I think, is by and large probably a good thing for a lot of instruments. But provided we're comfortable that the exchange has got the appropriate capacity and appropriate capitalisation, but there is a concern that those people who have more direct access to that exchange, which is sort of basically the large global financial institutions, are going to gain an increasing share of that business, as it's not necessarily going to be worthwhile, say, an Australian customer going through Westpac, who then has to go through one of those global banks to access the exchange, rather than be able to access it directly. So I think there is some risk that there might be an increase in market concentration beyond what is already a reasonably concentrated market. So that's one thing that we are certainly thinking about here, and I think that's one development that you may well see over the next year or two.
Hi, Luke Cornelio from Westpac. This is a question from the floor. Is the RBA being quizzed about a housing bubble by foreign investors?
So when I travel overseas, do people ask me about the Australian housing market? Yes, they do. So I'm not sure if that's being quizzed, but it's been... I mean, it's certainly the case that a lot of investors are interested in the Australian housing market. I would say we probably get asked a reasonable number of questions about that. Yeah.
Robert Rennie from Westpac. Guy, and possibly related to Paul's earlier question, I guess that shows the extent to which the banks are concerned about regulation. You mentioned when you were discussing the daily turnover in FX that you felt that high-frequency algorithmic trading was playing a part. That certainly would be our sense as well. Is there a concern, is there a focus on this within some of the foreign exchange bodies, the BIS, the ACI, etc.? We've had a flash crash in equity markets. Is there inherent instability there? And, you know, we get a lot more chat about Tobin taxes, financial transaction taxes. Is that another risk as well?
I mean, we're spending some amount of time getting a better understanding of the high-frequency trading and what impact it's having on local markets. So that's something we're looking at the moment, as I'm pretty confident a number of other countries around the world. Obviously, the focus at the moment has been on the has been more so on the equity market, where obviously there's a fair bit of investigation going on in the US. But it is something we're trying, at least as much try and get a better understanding of. Does seem to have grown reasonably rapidly over the last few years, along with the improvement in technology. So that is something that we are devoting some resources to getting a better understanding of. But and to try and get an idea of just how what sort of role it's playing in the market. As I showed you there for the foreign exchange market, by and large, with the exception, you know, in 08 and 09, liquidity was clearly an issue, which had nothing to do with high frequency or otherwise. In fact, trading through 08, last part of 08 and the fairly first part of 09 was incredibly low frequency, particularly in some of those days where turnover really dried up. And since then, by and large, there has not been an issue with liquidity in foreign exchange markets at all.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Guy, pretty spectacular statistics with regard to the increase in turnover for the Aussie, 40%, Canada 50%. What economic fundamentals do you think are driving that? And do you think this will be that we can continue to expect to see us outperforming our weight like that in those foreign currency markets?
I think there are two things going on. One is the relative fundamentals of those two economies, which are obviously both related to, you know, both commodity exporters. I think that's one of the driving forces. I think the other one is actually, to some extent, a diversification story as well, which, again, both Aussie and the Canadian dollar are the recipients of probably just... And, I talked about liquidity, and I talked about this. I mean, to some extent, the fact that we are a large market, as is the Canadian market, and a liquid market, makes us disproportionately attractive relative to other currencies. So, as I said, you know, people are confident that they can execute a trade in the Australian market without having any problem of getting out if they want to. So that tends to, I think, see more trades come through in this market than might otherwise do, and the same story is true in Canada. So I think it's a function of both the economic fundamentals and as well as the market fundamentals.
Stephen Halmery, excuse me, Colonial First State Global Asset Management. Just related to Bill's question, I think there is a fair bit of evidence that, you know, overseas central banks want to own more Aussie bonds. That's certainly the feeling. And in addition, you've got, you know, probably new BIS rules that means domestic banks are going to have to own more Aussie government bonds as well. So just in terms of that demand side, you know, big increase in central bank demand for Aussie government paper, how do you think that's going to change the structure of the market here between, you know, governments, semis, corporates? Do you think the corporates just fill the space, or kangaroos, or, you know, you think the market's going to continue to evolve?
I mean, we don't know any more than really anyone else does about central bank interest. Probably I even know less than some people in this room about that. And there's actually not that much information that we're able to get on that. But, you know, they have the same stories that everyone else does. It depends on them. Some of those guys can only buy AAA, can only buy the sovereign name. Some of them can buy sovereigns and semis. Some of them can buy sovereigns, semis and supras. So it varies depending on which central bank you're talking about as to what sort of assets they're going to be interested in. I'm not sure that... I'm not sure that demand is necessarily going to drive supply in terms of the composition. So I think supply will be determined by the issuers to a reasonable extent. Obviously, pricing matters, but I think supply will be determined by the issuers, and, you know, That might affect relative pricing, but I'm not sure it's going to affect the actual the different volumes out there.
Vivek Prabhu, Perpetual Investments. I just had a question about liquidity. You've mentioned some of the stats around the liquidity of the forex markets, and you've talked about primary issuance in the bond markets, but I was wondering if you had any observations on liquidity of corporate debt in terms of bid offer spreads or turnover pre and post GFC?
The market we pay most attention to is at the moment, at least, is the RMBS market, and the liquidity in the secondary market there is not great. It wasn't so much of an issue pre 2007. In those markets, in both the corporate bond market and the RMBS market, volumes are just not particularly high, and so liquidity. I'm not sure in the corporate market's any worse than it was pre 2007. I'm not sure it was all that great before 2007 either. I mean, most people are generally looking at it as a buy and hold market rather than, wanting there to be a strong secondary market. I think in bank paper, I think the liquidity is clearly better. Obviously, at the short end of the curve in the bill market, the liquidity there is as good as it ever, broadly speaking, is as good as it ever was. And further out on the curve, again, I'd say for financial institutions, it's probably as good as it ever. Certainly, I wouldn't say it's any worse than it was before 2007. But in those other markets, in the RMBS market, in part affected by the overhang of supply, which is still, not large, but still out there, liquidity is certainly not fantastic.
Guy, another question from the floor. Has there been a greater degree of communication and coordination between the world's central banks, and do you see this continuing?
We always met on a very. In fact, I'm off there to Basel tomorrow. I suppose in 2008 I did 9 or 10 trips to Basel, and this year I'm doing 5. Which reflects the state of global financial markets, I think. That's a reasonably good indicator. But there always had been good communication between central banks. I think it's true to say that it got ramped up, reflecting the circumstances in from sort of 07, 08 and 09. We saw a hell of a lot more of each other, probably, than we had done prior to that, and to some extent the fact that you do that means it's much easier to maintain communication. So, the volume of face-to-face contact increased, so while you guys weren't able to get on planes because of budget constraints, we were the ones filling those empty seats, though not necessarily in the same class as you guys. But that's scaled back a bit more recently on my side, but if you on Malcolm Eady's side, on the financial stability side, through the Basel Committee process, then between now, they're just meeting sort of almost constantly on including 2 days ago. So that interaction between on the regulatory side has certainly ramped up.
So, Guy, clearly this dominance of the US dollar in turnover of market share, et cetera, will one day end when we see the RMB floating. What's your general speculation on the timing of something like that, and when might those currency markets change so dramatically as would be the case when that was to happen?
I think that's almost impossible to answer when that will happen. If you look at the switch between when sterling was a reserve currency and the US dollar was a reserve currency. When the point was when people shifted from one to the other, I think it would have been impossible to have predicted in advance. It's not even clear that will necessarily happen for the RMB anytime soon. But the Chinese are clearly developing the depth of their market, gradually opening up their market, which have announced more things again over the past month or two. There's a gradual process there of deepening and whatever, and you obviously need to have a deep market, and a market, as I was talking earlier about the Aussie and the Canadian dollar, you want to have a market where you know you can transact easily in a liquid market. You need those preconditions to be established before, you know, you're in any consideration of being a being a global reserve currency. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what that time frame is, but those are the steps which have to be which you have to progress along.
Would you have it as longer than I'm not talking about it immediately becoming the reserve currency, but when it becomes a currency that will float and trade in that? Would you look at 10 years or beyond that, or 5 years?
I don't know. I mean, it partly depends what I think it's got something depend on what's happening in the rest of the world as well. As I said, they've done a there's been a reasonable amount over the past, even over the past sort of 6 months, in terms of opening up the market to more foreign investors and enhancing the infrastructure of the market. Some of that stalled in 08 and 09, given the conditions in global markets. So again, it will partly depend on what's going on in the rest of the world as much as what the Chinese themselves want to do.